As you write your life story, you're far from finished. Are you looking to close the book on your job? Maybe turn a page in your career? Be continued at the Georgetown University School of Continuing Studies. Our professional master's degrees and certificates are designed to meet you where you are and take you where you want to go. At Georgetown SCS, the learning never stops, and neither do you. Write your next chapter. Be continued at scs.georgetown.edu/podcast.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hey, it's Wendy.
And it's Jess, and you're listening to the Food Heaven Podcast,
your online resource for delicious and nutritious living. Hey everyone, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Food Heaven Podcast with Wendy and Jess. Today we have a very special guest. We have Virgie Tovar joining us. Virgie is the author of You Have the Right to Remain Fat. She is one of the nation's leading experts and lecturers on fat discrimination and body image, and the founder of Babe Camp, a four-week online course designed to help women break up with diet culture. She lives in San Francisco and holds a master's degree in sexuality studies. Interesting. With a focus on the intersections of body size, race, and gender. She pens a weekly column called Take the Cake and is a contributor for Forbes.com. Welcome to the podcast, Virgie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So we are so thrilled to have you here on the podcast. We both have a copy of your book and love it. I have it up in my office. And I just wanted to learn a little bit more about you in terms of, like, tell us what experiences led you to doing education on fat discrimination and body image, because I feel like this is something that it's growing a little bit in popularity, but I still feel like even the title of your book, I can see, like, you know, some people thinking that that's like revolutionary, or, you know, or that they haven't heard that concept before. But yeah, talk about what led you to this path.
Yeah, well, I mean, I have always been a fat person and I've always lived in a fat-hating world. So I think that's like the very beginning of the story in a lot of ways. I essentially was assimilated into a thin world where I was taught that everything that made me special and powerful was a flaw. And so I've always been like the biggest kid in my class. And I, you know, now I know that I had all of these special qualities that made me a thriving fat person, but I was taught that I was a failing thin person, which is, a major myth, right? Fat people are just fat people. They're not fat people. Fat people aren't thin people who are bad at being thin, or, well, you know what I'm saying? And so there's kind of this idea that there's a thin person inside every fat person, and people like Oprah and a number of other people have kind of like confirmed this idea that there's like an alien thin person living inside of every fat person.
Thin from
within.
That's
not a real thing. And so I was introduced to fat phobia at the age of 5 when I was in kindergarten, and I was taught that my body was wrong, disgusting, vile, that I was unlovable and bad and wrong, and that I deserve to be punished and isolated as a result of my transgression for being fat. And it took me a while to really internalize that education, because that's not the education where, you know, we're taught that. We're not born believing that something's wrong with us. Our culture teaches us those things. And so I internalized that education, and the way that I sort of acted out my understanding of my wrongdoing was through dieting and weight restricting. And so I spent about 20 years starving myself, not eating enough, going into periodic episodes of obsessive extreme exercise and food restriction. And then I was, through kind of a series of events, right, I ultimately was introduced to fat activism. And the particular kind of brand of fat activism that I was introduced to was like a queer femme focused activism, where there was room to no longer diet and also to live this fabulous, sparkly, unapologetic life, which I'd been taught that you could only have if you were thin. And so once I met people, fat people who were living like that, I was completely transformed and converted. And along the way, and this happened while I was in graduate school studying fatness and trying to understand the history of dieting and fatness. And at the time, which was 2011 and 2012, there was very, very, very little work on this issue. There was a handful of books and articles altogether over maybe, I don't know, 50 years of some, maybe 45 years of people writing here and there about this issue. But anyway, you know, I used the resources I had access to understand the history of diet culture. And I sort of discovered that it was deeply disgusting, deeply based in mythology, racism, classism, and definitely sexism. And that, you know, as a person who is politically minded, compassionate, and intelligent, I wanted to have nothing to do with that. And that I was very focused on eradicating it and helping people understand what I had learned.
Did you find that some of the fat phobia was also coming from people within your family and community? Because I think with body size, it's just seen so differently depending on the culture that you're from. So for me, for example, being Dominican, like having a larger body is something that can be celebrated depending on what kind of curvy body you have, which is a whole nother episode. But can you talk a little bit about your experience with your family and kind of like what they think about the work that you're doing now?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like my family, there was kind of these dual realities happening. On the one hand, I think it's important to name the fact that my family is deeply assimilationist. So I come from a Mexican Iranian heritage, but I was raised by my mother's family. So I was raised in a Mexican household. And yeah, my family was not like a group of proud Mexicans. They were very much like, you know, keep your head down. You're always gonna, you know, you're always gonna have to work twice as hard to get half as much, you know, be nice to white people and try and talk like them, you know, kind of a thing. And so I think that's an important background to kind of name, right? Interestingly, however, there's like this kind of, yeah, that's sort of one part of it. Another part of it is I grew up in a deeply Mexican tradition of parenting, which is that your children are sacred, right? Like, I mean, I think that Mexican parents and sort of like Latin history, Latin culture, and probably in most places, I would say, there's sort of this real understanding of children as like this blessing. And often children, at least in Mexico, their nicknames are like king and queen, like little king and little queen. And my nickname growing up was Reina, which was like queen, right, in Spanish. And so it was an interesting kind of meld of things where they absolutely adored me, right? I grew up with a family of people who desperately wanted to have a baby girl and loved having a baby in the house. And I had everything I wanted and I was spoiled and all these kinds of things. And I was the most beautiful girl in the world and the smartest girl in the world and all these kinds of things. And so I was not introduced to fat phobia in my household growing up. I was introduced to it in school, primarily by boys who were my peers. However, once I began engaging in dieting behavior, I uncovered kind of like a secret well of dieting behavior and fat phobic attitudes that my mother and grandmother had towards themselves. And so, you know, like my grandmother still wears a girdle every day. You know, she's like in her 70s now, but she's worn a girdle since she was maybe 15, 16, and she wears it every day. And, you know, and then like my mother, I found out, had slightly more acute sort of eating disordered behavior than I did. My grandmother has always been a restrictor and believes that like eating as little as possible is a sign of femininity and a sign of good health. My mother sort of was one of the first people who ever taught me in my deepest, darkest moments of desperation about wanting to not be a fat person because I was treated so poorly. And you know, she as a fat person also had developed tools. And one of them was purging and binging. And she was, you know, the first person who ever introduced me to the concept that one of the things that you could do to not be fat was to eat too much of the things that you love. Just create a list of the things that you love to eat the most and then ruin them systematically by eating too much and throwing up so that in your mind, the memory of that food is associated with a negative physical outcome, which is eating disorder behavior, right? And so, you know, and it, again, like the context is not malicious. They weren't interested in kind of maintaining my historical oppression and the way that they had been oppressed. They were at their sort of wit's end in trying to help me navigate fat phobia. And these were the tools that they had developed. And so they sort of taught me once I was in that same place as them. But in general, general, right, like it's complicated in terms, I feel like my mother very much supports my work and is touched by my work. I think my grandmother is impressed by like my, you know, publications and being on TV and stuff like that. But I think she largely is like, no, a woman's job is to be small and to be at home and to have babies. And, you know, it's kind of great that you're independent, but it's not going to last as the childhood naive dream that you have of changing the world. And so, so it's like an interesting combination.
Wow. I feel like there's so much that you said that I want to unpack. And one of the things I'm so glad you touched on was just the idea of the disordered eating and eating disorders that we tend to not understand or acknowledge or realize that those affect people of color as well. I work now a lot with patients who have eating disorders and disordered eating, and I would say at least 60% of them are women of color, and even some men of color too. So I think it does us a disservice to not acknowledge that that can be going on within some of our communities.
Yeah. I mean, I think also, right, like it's kind of in the, whether it's, I think it might even be formally in sort of the diagnosis, but it's certainly informally and in the grander cultural sort of mindset, an eating disordered person is a white girl who's very, very small. And that's often, right, fat, there are lots and lots and lots of fat people and people of color, right, people who are not thin white women who have eating disorders and don't even know it because they don't have the body that's associated with eating disorder. Like there are so many fat people who are essentially engaging in anorexia, but if a fat person goes into a doctor and says, I'm worried I have anorexia, they will literally be laughed out of the room in most cases. And so I think obviously our framework around what EDs are and how they manifest, they're these things are deeply flawed.
I agree 100%. And I think even too, you're right, because people who may be in larger bodies, they are dismissed as like not, like they don't even look for an eating disorder within those folks. And they don't even know the questions to kind of ask to see kind of what is really going on. So I just, yeah, want to put that out there that it is something that affects all of us across the spectrum. Now, before you came to a place of body acceptance, were there any fatphobic experiences you encountered in your younger years that you felt like really marked you?
Yes, I mean, for sure. Yeah, one of the things that I talk a lot about, especially in my new book, but in general, when I do lectures and all kinds of things, I talk a lot about the way that the boys I grew up with really shaped how I saw myself, and how as I've looked through the history of this issue, and I've looked at the history of gender and food and body size and whatnot, it's no accident that I got the education and my worthlessness from boys who are my age. This is not uncommon, right? And so I think like my education around fat phobia really came around the idea that no one would ever love me if I stayed fat. And that was the thing that kept getting drilled into me over and over and over and over again by boys in my class at my school. And that was the thing that kind of really, you know, left the biggest impression on me. Because I mean, I grew up in a culture, I mean, in the US, right, where I'm surrounded by images of what it means to be a successful, worthwhile girl. And that is when a man is by your side. So that was every movie I was watching, every ad, every single thing that was targeted at me as a child was about the idea that I would achieve adulthood and complete humanity through marriage with a man. And so what these boys were teaching me was that if I stayed the size that I was, I would essentially not matter to my culture, that I would not have access to the most important kind of love that my culture saw, right? And so deemed as such. And that's major, right? Like what fat phobia does is that it sort of comes into the fat person's life and says, you can't be a full citizen, you can't be a full person, and you cannot be a full adult in this culture until you are thin. And so, right, like this is a horrifying prospect. I mean, I can talk about a million moments, right? Where like weird, awful, horrendous things happen. It was wild because the other night, actually, I'll tell you one story that was specific. It was so moving and wild and gross and horrifying. And the other day I was doing a photo shoot with a bunch of fat babes. And by the, you know, one of the things we did was we had to do a costume change. And so we ended up kind of all going into this little guest house that the photographer had. And we're all kind of changing our clothes and we're sitting around and we're like, you know, we're eating chips and eating Cheetos and chatting and drinking like hard cider. And I don't know how, what ends up happening is we're talking about like, oh my God, this is the fat sleepover that we always wanted and that we never had. And then someone started talking about the awful things that had happened to them at sleepovers. And then we all had these horrible stories. And it was always about being fat, right? So it was like, you know, like one girl talked about, you know, like, I don't want to share her story, but like, I certainly talked about like, you know, I went to a slumber party. It was all thin girls and me, and they waited until I fell asleep. And a couple of them like put milk and soy sauce all over my hair and my eyebrows. And then the next morning I woke up and I was gross and I wanted to take a shower, but I was so afraid that they would burst into the bathroom and like shame my body that I didn't take a shower. And then they shamed me for being dirty and disgusting. And then essentially all the people in the group had terrible stories like that. Like one woman, one now woman, but as a child was at a slumber party. And she said that like some of the thin girls filled up the sink with water and then kind of enticed her to go look at it and then pushed her head down into the water. And it was just like, like story after story after like a room full of fat girls talking about what it's like being fat in this world, in this culture where we're essentially viewed as less than human. And so I think that there are just thousands, hundreds of stories that are in my life as well as the history of other fat people.
Wow, that's terrible. And thank you for sharing, because I think when talking about fat phobia, especially for people that aren't fat, it's like something that you hear about or that comes into the conversation, but these examples and these stories aren't really discussed. And so I think that there's a disconnection there. So I think it's really powerful that you were all able to talk about it. And did you feel some healing through talking about these stories with other people that have been through similar experiences?
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know that I would call it healing. I think it was more like intimacy. And I guess maybe intimacy. I mean, for me, yeah, I guess it was healing like via intimacy. It's very important for me to be close to other fat people. That's one of the biggest things that like has really changed my life. You know, as a fat person, you're taught to stay away from other fat people because somehow they'll make you look fatter or look worse or, you know, and I mean, I think that it's like, it's just self-hatred is what it is. But like, I was one of those fat people who used to be terrified of being friends with fat people. I thought that it was important for me to be friends with thin people because it would not only help me want to be thinner, but it would make me look less bad or less like a loser. And so now that I'm kind of in this like acceptance and self-love space, one of the most important things for me is to be close to fat people. And so absolutely there was kind of like this intimacy building and this kind of the power of witnessing and the power of kind of, you know, knowing that someone understands what you've been through. And I think that there's a way in which when fat people are together, at least as far as I've noticed, there's a silent language that we share. Like we understand certain things and we kind of gesture at certain things and we kind of have like there's a way that our bodies indicate a shared experience in this really special way. And I think what's interesting about that night is we kind of rendered a lot of that silent language into actual language and sort of talked about these things.
So switching gears a little bit, because I know we mentioned that you have a background with sexuality studies. And so I'm interested in how your experiences have affected your love life. You can share as much as you like. You don't need to like share your booze or who you or what's happening in your love life right now. But just like generally, how do you feel like all this information that you have now has affected your love life?
Yeah, I mean, I think as with many things, there's like these incredible layers of complexity, right? Like on the one hand, having to grow up, you know, dealing with fat phobia, feeling like an outsider, it created this extraordinary path out of the mainstream. And that path has been beautiful and like I don't know. I don't even like sparkly. I'm tearing up just even thinking about it, right? Like, I mean, what's happened is I've met all these people who are weirdos, who don't fit, who don't like the way that our culture works. And those are the people in my world, right? The people who have, by virtue of like living in this horrifically violent culture, have had to learn how to heal and love and speak and exist and dress differently than you know, what they've been taught. And I think it's this, I don't know, it's like this extraordinarily rich sort of subcultural reality that I've had access to by virtue of being a fat person. And it's, so it's interesting in that way, right? Where like my fatness has acted as like this vetting tool. Like I get to not have to deal. I get to see people as they really are because they don't think that I'm someone who they have to hide their mask for. You know, I mean, they don't have to hide behind their mask because in this culture, I don't matter enough for them to hide. And so I get to see who they really are. And I get to decide right away if I want to be around that or not. You know, like I can't tell you, I mean, I'm somebody who dates men. I can't tell you like how many men have showed me who they are. And I know that if I had been thin, they would have hidden that from me because they would have tried to enlist me in becoming part of their social capital, right? Like, because men are taught in this culture to gain social capital between and among other men by accumulating thin-bodied women and showing them off as capital, right? And so like that's obviously very dehumanizing in the same way that like, you know, him not thinking that I matter enough to sort of put on artifice is also dehumanizing, right? But like we're in this similar boat in that way, I feel. But all that to say, right, like I've gotten to see them in their truest form immediately. And I'm like, oh, you're a horrible person. I don't want to have anything to do with you. I can move on to someone who isn't a horrible person. And that's fantastic. I think there's also these weird weights. Like one of the things I wrote about in the book, which I was like, not sure if I wanted to include it, because it's like, it's a little bit complicated and nuanced and maybe even, I don't know, like it's a weird thing to share. But one of the things that really blew my mind was how, because I am fat and was fat, one of the benefits was that boys in my, it was like a drawback at the time, but now as an adult, one of the benefits of being fat was that boys didn't want to date or marry me, like the boys in my neighborhood. And I noticed with my thinner classmates, they immediately kind of like descended upon the thinnest women in my peer group and attempted to claim them. And a lot of them ended up sort of staying in my small town that I don't really like that much and don't think that's awesome. And, you know, they got married really young and they had children very, very young because I think because the men in their lives were pressuring them to sort of, they wanted to lay claim to these women. And one of the ways that you do that is you marry one and you impregnate one as quickly as possible before she can learn who she is or what the world has to offer her. You know, she's already kind of like sidled down with this man's world that he wants to create for her, right? And so, and because I was not desirable in that way, I kind of had this clear passage out of my tiny, stifling, conservative town. I got to sexually experiment. I got to like travel the world. I got to get an education, right? Because no man wanted to lay claim to my failed woman's body. And so it's like this interesting thing where, I don't know, like, and I think the last thing I'm going to share is one of the things that blows my mind the most, right, is like, what? So again, nobody wanted to date me in high school. I was a horny, nerdy Mexican girl, right, like huge glasses, like kind of like Mexican Tina Belcher. And I was obsessed with like having a boyfriend. I love butts and like all this stuff. And so no one in my class will date me because I'm fat. And so I end up finding this telephone personal service that's free for women. And I didn't know this at the time, but like all the men on there, A, had to pay. And as a result, B, were like older businessmen. And so I end up, my first experiences dating as like a fat girl, 17-year-old, were like dating businessmen who were feeding me like foie gras and filet mignon and like amazing restaurants in San Francisco. And like, again, my friends who I was growing up with, who were like much more conventionally attractive, or maybe my peers more than my friends, you know, they were not having those experiences, right? Because they were having these like normal dates for a 16-year-old, right? Which is like going to Carl's Jr. or whatever. And so I just kind of find it fascinating that like, absolutely, there were all of these heartbreaks and the sense of rejection and the sense that I was wrong. And I've had to navigate and wade through a lot. But I think at the end of the day, like succeeding on this culture's terms are not something that I'm interested in. And I kind of was forced into that realization through my fat body. But ultimately, I think that it like entirely benefited me, if that makes sense. Not to downgrade the horribleness of fat phobia, but to kind of just to give context of how it landed for me, you know?
Yeah, that's a very unique perspective. I don't think I've ever heard it talked about through this lens, how you kind of like saw this as an opportunity to really explore your sexuality and your womanhood in a very independent way. That's so dope.
Hey, I want to take a short pause to talk about how cold it is in New York City. I've been looking for a nice coat for a few months now and haven't had much luck. Recently, I found out about Poshmark, and let's just say lives were changed. Instead of having to buy a whole new coat on Poshmark, you can shop from millions of closets around the United States. Whether you're a high-end shopper like my mom or you like to keep it more frugal like me, they have tons of brands to choose from, and they also offer a range of price points, which is really nice. I've been eyeing this J. Crew peacoat, and I'm going to leave it right there because I want to make sure it's still available after this episode. Poshmark is such an easy way to buy fashion items. They've got everything from shoes to purses, dresses, and more. If you're that person with the million and one things in your closet that you've been dying to get rid of, guess what? You can sell it on Poshmark. If you download the free Poshmark app, you'll be able to see all of the selections for women, kids, and men. Oh, and shipping, super easy and fast. Make sure you go to Poshmark.com right now and enter the invite code FOODHEAVEN to get $5 off your first purchase. Again, that's Poshmark.com and enter the invite code FOODHEAVEN. All right, let's get back to our episode.
Okay, so let's talk about healthcare because we both work in clinics and we have seen from healthcare providers the many ways that providers can discriminate against fat people. And so can you talk to us a little bit about your experience seeking medical care and maybe if there's been ways that you've been able to advocate in healthcare settings, if you could share that too for listeners who have challenges with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I want to lead by saying like doctors have some of the most, at least in terms of like, you know, professions that have been studied and have been given questionnaires and whatnot. Doctors have some of the most demonstrated consistent high levels of fat phobia than any profession. And it's kind of important to like really, I think, lead with that. And I mean, I also want to say, my relationship with the medical industry was radically transformed when I was introduced to feminism in my very early 20s. I think I was like 21 or maybe even 20 when I was lucky enough to meet a bunch of, you know, kind of like militant feminists in college. And one of the first things they taught me was the history of the medical industry, which, you know, if you're horrified by the diet history, the diet culture history, the medical industry history is just much, I think, like orders of magnitude more horrifying when we're talking about people of color or women. I think certainly in the contemporary world around fatness. But yeah, they kind of taught me, right, that I needed to have a much more guarded and boundaried relationship to the medical industry than I'd been taught, right? Similar to the police, we're taught that doctors are our friends and they're there to help us. The truth is, right, like most doctors are trained to be very, like quite hostile towards like women, towards queer people, towards fat people, towards disabled people, towards people of color. And that, you know, I don't know that it's like in our, like certainly around fatness, it is like an overt bigotry that is, I think, taught in medical environments. Among the other categories, it might be a little bit more subtle, but like certainly evidence shows that like people of color are less likely to be given antidepressants. Queer people are less likely to be given antidepressants when they express symptoms of depression than their straight counterparts. And I think overall, like the medical industry is not a friend to fat people. And so when again, my introduction to medical self-advocacy was around gynecological care. And these feminists, we would sit down and we would do role plays where, you know, there'd be scripts and essentially we would have to deal with like being patronized, right? How do we deal with a doctor who's telling us that we don't know what's going on with our body? How do we deal with a medical examination that has become rude and uncomfortable for us? How do we walk out of an appointment? How do we find a new doctor if we don't feel comfortable with the one that we have? You know, and it was just kind of, it was extraordinarily empowering. And ever since I was, you know, 20 or 21, I've always brought that kind of like no bullshit militant feminist attitude to medical care. And it has served me very well. Even with that in mind, I think that obviously, like, I think that it's important to sort of look at medical care in a few different dimensions. And I'm going to talk about two because I think they're the most important. So the first one is the interpersonal, right? The face-to-face, your doctor's being a fat phobe and you're dealing with him trying to blame your weight on literally everything. That's a very, very common thing, right? Like where we'll come in with one symptom and we're being told that our weight is to blame, whether it's strep throat or back pain or hair is falling out or literally anything, right? If you're a fat person, you're likely going to get, the first response you're going to get is that you need to lose weight, right? This is essentially negligence and it's bigotry, just like pretty much. And so, right, like there's that reality that like fat people are denied good medical care from doctors all the time. The second dimension is more the institutional dimension, which is not the like a doctor is not giving me care. It's more like the way that the medical infrastructure kind of exists. So for instance, birth control is not, the efficacy of birth control is not tested above a certain weight. Like they found out in the UK, and I don't have this finding for the US, but they found out in the UK that the morning after pill was not effective after 167 pounds, I believe it was, and it had mediated effectiveness at 167 pounds and was completely ineffective after like 180 pounds, right? A lot of American women are above 180 or 165 pounds. And the truth is, right, like if you're a fat person who's taking birth control, it is entirely likely that the doctors have no idea how efficacious that birth control is. Like if you're above 200 pounds, let's say, like I am. And then things like, you know, like medical equipment, not feeling sturdy or not being wide enough for fat patients, right? Again, this is not interpersonal, this is institutional. And so, and I think, I guess I will add the third dimension, which is the intrapersonal. And I always look at fat phobia along these three dimensions, inter, intra, and institutional. Intrapersonally, fat people often opt out of medical care because they're anticipating shaming. What we've learned is after a doctor tells a fat person to lose weight, this often leads to binging immediately thereafter. So I guess what I'm kind of like trying to share with you is like we're in a dire situation with medical care. It is not the fault of fat people. It's certain, but unfortunately the advocacy is very effective, I've found. So I guess my tips would be like, A, be very clear going in what you do and do not want to do. I would say also 2, you do not have to be weighed. You can say no to a weigh-in. 3, you can always end an appointment at any time if you feel uncomfortable or like you're being disrespected. 4, I say right off the bat with a new doctor, I am interested in a weight neutral approach. I have no interest in weight loss whatsoever. And if you bring up any weight loss measures, I will end the appointment. And I think that like what's really complicated about all of this is like it feels terrifying to a person who maybe isn't used to self-advocating, but it's actually much easier than you think. And I think the last thing I want to say is, right, like go into the doctor. This might be a little bit harshy poo, but I'm just going to say it. Like, I think it's important to approach the medical industry as like kind of a sleazy salesman, not really like your brother, your dad's friend, or you're like, oh, he's going to take care of me. More like, what is this person going to try and sell me? I should have an appropriate amount of suspicion and guardedness around this. And then if they prove that they're like awesome and rad, great. You can create like a beautiful relationship with that person or that medical care group or something. But until I would say like guilty until proven innocent rather than the other way around.
Oh my God. You said so many amazing things. I loved all of your tips because I do get that from folks I work with where they just have had bad experiences with medical providers, and the work that we do sometimes can feel a little bit like derailed once, you know, if they're going to see a doctor who doesn't support the weight, you know, inclusive approach. So thank you so much for all those tips.
Okay, hold that thought really quickly. I just want to take a minute to talk about one of our sponsors for this week's episode. So a couple of years ago, Wendy and I wrote an article for BuzzFeed called Here's How Dietitians Actually Eat Healthy Without Going Broke. And one of the strategies that we mentioned was to sign up for a discount delivery service like Thrive Market. Now, if you haven't heard about Thrive before, allow me to fill you in. They are a revolutionary online marketplace on a mission to make healthy living easy and affordable. At Thrive, you can shop for thousands of the best-selling non-GMO foods and natural products, and you will always save about 25 to 50% below the retail prices. They're actually the largest retailer in the country that sells exclusively non-GMO groceries, which we find to be pretty cool. You can find everything on Thrive, from snacks to vitamins to supplements to personal care products, eco-friendly cleaning supplies, safe and non-toxic beauty products, literally even organic baby food. Thrive has all of it, and it all can be shipped straight to your door. Now, for those of you who are ratings junkies like me, like I will never buy anything that is under 4 stars or eat at a restaurant under 4 stars. I like that you can search through the products based on the average customer rating. I know you guys are thinking by now, you're like, okay, this all sounds good and whatnot, but can I just go on Amazon? And the answer is no, you cannot go on Amazon, because here's why. More than 70% of the Thrive Market catalog actually cannot be found on Amazon at all. So they have a bunch of unique stuff that you can't find on the Zon. Made that up. So if you want to shop smart and save money, go to thrivemarket.com/foodheaven and enjoy a 30-day free trial plus 25% off your entire order. So this is basically a no-brainer, you guys. Go to thrivemarket.com. That's thrivemarket.com/foodheaven. FOODHEAVEN. And get to saving today. Now back to the episode.
Now, can you talk a little bit about, you know, your journey when it comes to body acceptance and appreciation, or not even necessarily journey, but just like, what are some things that have really helped you come to that place of, you know, body appreciation? And then also, is this an ongoing process that you work through? Because I have people where, you know, I may have worked with them for, let's say, a year, and they have, you know, come a long way, but then they get really discouraged because they're always kind of triggered by this thin ideal, you know, anywhere they go. And so they kind of sometimes end up feeling like, oh man, like I'm not where I feel like I quote unquote should be. They feel bad about themselves, and that can even trigger them. So for you, yeah, is it ongoing?
Yeah. I mean, to answer the second part first, it is ongoing, right? If you think about fat phobia as a form of cultural abuse, and you sort of scale it down to this like micro scale where it's maybe, you know, where you take a grand scale thing like fat phobia and you kind of distill it down to like, let's say you lived with someone who hit you, right? It's like one of those things where you can go to therapy every day, but like if you come home every night and get smacked around, you're not going to make a whole lot of progress, or your progress is going to be slowed, you know, intensely by the fact that you have ongoing abuse, right? It's, I think, unlike other forms of abuse that people are dealing with, there's many people who are dealing with abuse that's safely in their past, right? Like if you were abused as a child, there are obviously ripple effects of that. But the truth is, you are never going to be 3 years old again. You are never going to like have complete powerlessness the way that a 3 year old does ever again. And as a survivor, you can begin to heal when you recognize that that is never going to happen again. When you're dealing with cultural abuse like fat phobia, you're trying to heal in the midst of being smacked down wherever you go. And so I think that it's important to sort of cut yourself some slack and be compassionate about the fact that you're still living in the environment that actively caused you this harm, and it's not going away anytime soon. And so I think it's important. I often tell people, don't bring the dieting mind into your healing process, where like we bring numbers and achievement and these sort of false notions of success and happiness to our healing process, because that's just not useful. And it's very hard, right? Because like dieting, diet brain or diet culture mind, whatever you want to call it, is highly supported by our culture. Like, capitalism is the same as diet mind. This idea that, like, you can work really, 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 really hard and have anything that you want. And if you don't have it, it's because you personally failed not wanting it badly enough, right? Diet mind is the same thing. And so there's a lot of culturally sanctioned, like, ideologies that kind of promote this idea that even when you're healing, you're not healing hard enough. You're not being great enough. You're not being, like, fat positive enough, right? And so I think that, right, like, I kind of want to put that into the domain of, like, mythology, right? There's, like, right, so healing is complex. For me, absolutely, it's an ongoing process. I think to kind of return to, like, the things that really brought me to body acceptance and, like, fat liberation, I mean, there are a lot of stories. I don't know. Like, I mean, I guess I'll tell a couple stories. Like, one of them was, you know, for the first time really meeting a community of fat women who were totally fabulous. And I tell the story in the book where I'm kind of at a conference for fat people. I've never been in a gathering of fat people in my life. And I kind of walk into the hotel in the pool area, and there's just all these babes everywhere, and they're wearing amazing bathing suits, and they're just looking fierce, and they're, like, laughing and tanning and floating in the pool. And then this one woman kind of comes out of, you know, stage left, and she's, like, sauntering out and wearing these, like, cat eye sunglasses, this red and white polka dot bathing suit. And she's kind of just, like, yeah, she's, like, sauntering, right? She's big arms and big belly and big thighs and big boobs. And then there's, like, a boy trailing behind her with a parasol over her head so that she won't get a sunburn. And even though, you know, I ended up becoming acquaintances with that person later on. We were never very close friends, but she kind of, like, really changed my life. And I think, you know, one other person who really kind of changed my life was somebody I dated. I met him in my mid-20s, and he was a feminist, and he was fat positive, and he kind of, I mean, he did this, I mean, I think, in my opinion, he was like a guardian angel. Like, if someone told me, oh, he never existed, who is that person? He was born in 1799, I'd be like, that's not surprising to me. So, like, he just was kind of like this ethereal, magical unicorn of a human who kind of came into my life and was just like, there's nothing wrong with you. And a man doesn't tell you what your body looks like. A man doesn't get to tell you what you do with your life or with your body or what you eat, right? Nobody does. He, like, recuperated my relationship to food in this incredible way. You know, like, he would just kind of stand near me while I was cooking, and he would kind of gently coax me into putting delicious stuff into the food, right? Because I was still grappling with dieting when I met him, and I could not accept, could not imagine a world where I wasn't dieting and restricting. And so I was terrified of food like bacon or cheese or mayonnaise or butter. You know, those kinds of things are terrifying when you're weight restricting. And he sort of demystified them and stopped, and, you know, and he was just so loving, you know, and he kind of, from a sexuality standpoint, right, like, he would ask to, like, watch me shower, you know, like, he loved it when I would wake up in the morning first thing, right, and, like, what I looked like the first thing in the morning was, like, his favorite image of me. And he kind of proudly stood by my side and helped me advocate. Like, one of the things that happened in grad school was my advisor told me not to research fatness and said that it was career suicide and said that no one cared about this issue and that everything about fatness had already been written. And this was in 2011, 2012. And he happened to be sitting outside of that meeting. And he sort of, when I stepped out of that meeting, he jumped up and was so angry. He was so angry at this person, my advisor, and just really like called her out for what she was, which was like a fat phobe. And, you know, and he's like a thin white guy with a New Zealand accent, right? Like, he has, like, you know, it just was like this extraordinary kind of experience of like, oh my God, this person is like putting all of his privileges into service to lifting me up, which, I mean, as I'm sure you know, is not the normal heterosexual game, right? Like, in normal heterosexual relationships, the man is trying to like get as much as he can, extract as much as he can from his woman partner in order to lift himself up. And it happens in like subtle and sometimes overt ways. But this was like not that at all. And so anyway, those are just kind of two like little stories, little vignettes of moments along my journey.
Yeah, he definitely sounds like a unicorn. Mm-hmm. And he sounds, yes. sounds like he needs to do a workshop around the world for other men.
For every man.
Get every guy on board with this. That sounds amazing. That's so beautiful. Are you still in touch with him?
You know, we lost touch. Like we were briefly engaged and I wasn't ready to get married and I don't know. And then I think I did a bunch of stupid things as a way to deal with it. And I think he got really mad, which is understandable.
Yeah. Damn. All right. Well, hopefully, shout out to you, whoever you are, wherever you are. Thanks for being awesome. Well, Virgie, I want you to tell us about your book and where people can learn more about your work. This has been so amazing. We've had such a great time talking with you and hearing about all of your experiences. So give us all the plugs.
Yes. So my new book is called You Have the Right to Remain Fat. It's out from the Feminist Press. You can get it on Amazon, pretty much wherever books are sold, and indie bookstores particularly. You can find me online at virgietovar.com, VirgieTovar.com. I'm also very active on Instagram at VirgieTovar. Please consider three more quick things. Please consider reading my column at ravishly.com. I'm a contributor to Forbes.com, so Women at Forbes or Forbes Women. I do work on fat phobia in the workplace. And then also I teach a course multiple times a year called Babe Camp, which is kind of like a fat feminist framework and understanding how to navigate diet culture with power.
Amazing. And we'll make sure that we include links for all of this so people can look it up. All right. Well, thank you for hopping on with us. This was so great. And yeah, we'll catch you on the flip side.
Bye, Virgie.
Yes.
All right. Bye, Virgie.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of the Food Heaven podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please do us a huge favor and leave us a review in iTunes right now. The more reviews we get, the higher we're ranked, which means that we reach more people. So listen up to this listener review. As a mom, we're always hearing, what do you do to take care of yourself? Well, being 2.5 years into motherhood and still dealing with a birthing injury, I now take 20 minutes a day to care for my injury and listen to the Food Heaven podcast while doing so. It's like I'm back in school, but even better. Thank you for this slice of heaven. Aw, thank you so much for those of you who take the time to leave those heartfelt reviews like these. And if you haven't already, please drop us some stars and some love.
Yes, and you can also connect with us online. We're at Food Heaven Show. Our podcast is released every Wednesday. In each episode, we cover tips and tricks for making lifelong, sustainable living changes to upgrade your diet and health. We also interview leading experts in the field of health and nutrition to pick their brains on how to cultivate a healthy life that you love. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we will catch you next time. Bye. Bye.
This podcast episode is sponsored by California Almonds. Question. Are you enjoying almonds as part of your healthy eating routine? Well, if not, listen up. We love almonds because they are a perfect trifecta of taste, health, and convenience. And as dietitians, we often recommend almonds to our clients because they have protein, fiber, and healthy fats and several other nutrients that work together to help you feel fueled and energized no matter what the day may bring.
Almonds are also great to bring with you on the road, to work, while traveling, or even before you hit the gym. Given almonds are one of our favorite nuts, we were shocked to learn that almonds do not have their own emoji. Rally with us to get an almond emoji by signing the petition at almonds.com/emoji-signup. And next time you go grocery shopping, make sure you throw some almonds in your cart. Enjoy!